Thanks for the opportunity to present my work and my future research prospects or ideas. So as the title suggests, I will be talking about quantum field theory and how we can use the tools of quantum information theory to develop new tools, new ideas, new language to understand the entanglement structure of quantum fields. The research strategy I will present is twofold, actually. So we will both use a top-down approach, which is based on applying information theoretic primitives and concepts to general quantum field theories. We will particularly consider Lorentz invariant quantum field theories. And when I mean general, I mean basically theories, quantum field theories, which are just defined in terms of certain axioms, for example, certain properties of its Weidman functions. And we will use these information theoretic concepts to learn something about the entanglement structure of such general theory. But we also will pursue a bottom-up approach, where we will focus on more specific examples, specific theories, and we will use the tools of tensor network theory, which is a field developed at the interface of quantum many-body theory and a quantum information theory. So we will use the tools from the theory to rigorously obtain new classes of ansatz states, new families of quantum states, which model in a geometrically local way the entanglement present in quantum field theory. So this is the bottom-up approach. I will present both results and future ideas strategies. My goal, let me put it like that, are rigorous mathematical results. So we will be focusing on proving theorems, especially because I think it's helpful to have analytic error bounds and to know certain analytic tools, especially even if you talk about quantum field theories, where many things are, sometimes not so easy to restate rigorously, but I think it's valuable to have some mathematical analytic results here. Before I want to go into details, let me say what is not covered in this talk. It's especially my research at the interface of the quantum information theory and operator algebra theory. For example, my works on Sillerson's problem and its connection to the quantum embedding problem. Also, not in this talk, I want to talk about my work on quantum cryptography, especially, for example, my work on the security of continuous variable QKD or my recent work on the security of randomness extractors against quantum side attacks. Randomness extractors are certain support calls which are often used in many cryptographic quantum, especially quantum cryptographic protocols. I also want to be talking about my work on non-commutative optimization, dealing with optimizing certain bilinear functions over non-commutative variables. Common to my research, I mean, also to these three topics and to the research I'm talking about, is that I combine tools from quantum information theory, operator algebra theory, and quantum field theories to obtain new insights, new ideas, new tools in either of these three fields. And common, of course, to these three fields are, of course, that we work with infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And so my tools are largely, of course, the tools of infinite dimensional algebra. I mean, that's the mathematical, let's say, basis of what I'm working on. But now let's go into the details of how we can use quantum information theory to learn something new about quantum field theory. My talk is structured in like five categories. So first, I will give you a little introduction for those of you who are like less familiar with quantum field theory, what I mean by a quantum field theory, and what is also known already. And then I will talk about the first results we achieved in the top-down approach. So talking about general primitives, general information theoretic primitives, and quantum field theories. I will also talk about the first results of obtaining rigorous tensor network approximations with exact error bounds. And then I will go into talk a bit about the future direction of such tensor network applying, future prospect of applying tensor network tools to quantum field theory, as well as future prospect in the top-down approach, which is going towards developing the theory of quantum protocols, quantum communication protocols for quantum field. First, the introduction. What is a quantum field theory? A quantum field theory is a quantum theory possessing a continuum of degrees of freedom. As such, these continuum of degrees of freedom are represented or like represent the values of space-time. Because we are especially looking at relativistic theories, we are talking about space-time. So we have, for example, in the most general case, R4 or R3 plus 1. Unlike what we know in quantum information theory, the theory, a quantum field theory, is usually defined in terms of its correlation functions. And these are correlation functions, these are expectation values with respect to usually a fixed state called the vacuum. And these are basically defined in terms of expectation values of measurements at certain points in space and time. Okay. And the collection of all of such correlation functions uniquely specifies the theory. Because we're talking about relativistic theories, we require that these correlation functions obey the symmetries of special relativity, for example, they are Lorentz invariant. Later on, we will also consider theories which have more symmetries, for example, local gauge invariants. But in general, we require Lorentz invariants. Okay. So the mathematical setting of quantum field theory is actually quite different than the usual one to quantum information theory for several reasons. The first reason, of course, is that the Hilbert space necessary is infinite dimensional. So because we have a continuum of degrees of freedom, the Hilbert space is, like for the exact theory is necessary infinite dimensional. Also, actually, not all operators on that Hilbert space are usually allowed physical observables, meaning that we have to require Lorentz invariants, and for example, for local gauge theories, we have to require the gauge symmetry. So it might be very well that actually the set of operators on the Hilbert space has to be restricted further to get the allowed set of physical observables. We can actually, in most cases, very general subsystems are not described by a tensor product of Hilbert space. So this might be true in an approximate sense, but it might also not be true in an approximate sense, but if we consider gauge theory, this will be the case. But in general, this absence of a nice tensor product structure, of course, implies that we need to develop further the usual tools of quantum information. Okay, so these tools, which are usually defined and explored on finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, have to be adapted to the setting, and this is, of course, one of my aims. What are known facts? What do we know already about the entanglement in quantum fields? So first of all, and it's a well-known fact and very often stated, is that the vacuum of any quantum field theory, of most quantum field theories, is like maximally entangled between any region and its complement. This is like very well known and can also be expressed as a statement that actually we can violate Bell inequality, so for example, the CHH inequality, maximally across any region and in bipartite cut, so to say. Okay, so we can always find local observables A1 and A0 located in a region, and B0 and B1 located in the complement, such that end state and the vacuum actually and get this violation. Of course, much more is known, and especially the case of one plus one dimensional conformal field theories, we know have very good understanding about scaling of the entanglement entropy in various weeks. very much work has been done in that regard, and some people who contribute to that study are also in the room. Moreover, also in the case of 3+1 dimensional, so the fully relativistic case, also many special cases or also general results are known about how the entanglement entropy of certain bounded regions scales. And in general, we have either an area law or an area law with logarithmic corrections, as in the case of conformal field theories, 1+1 dimension. And so we know already that the entanglement in quantum field theory is of a very, very special type. So it doesn't have an area law, a volume law, for example, which is possible for most general quantum states, but So we already know that it has a special structure. But of course, what we don't know yet so much is like how the local entanglement, like especially the multipartite entanglement, behaves. And this is one of the aims of this of my work, actually, to get a deeper understanding of this center. Okay. So after
I have a question. What do you mean by the vacuum is maximally entangled?
Actually, can we postpone that question to later to the talk, because I will make that precise.
Okay.
Okay. One way to state this is like, for example, you say that the Bell inequalities are maximally violated. But I will make that even more precise. What it means, what the entanglement of a vacuum of the vacuum is. Okay, let me come to the results. And as I promised, we first start with a top-down approach. So the strategies, to remind you, is to apply information theoretic primitives to learn more about the structure of quantum entanglement, of quantum correlation, and general quantum theory. For example, to answering the question, what is the entanglement of the vacuum? I will present two results in that regard. First, I will talk about our results of measuring entanglement in gauge theories. And then I actually will answer Gifter's question and characterize entanglement in general Lorentz invariant theories in the vacuum. Okay. So let me start with the first result, the measuring entanglement in gauge theory. What is a gauge theory? A gauge theory is a quantum field theory which has additional local symmetries, meaning that we have at each point in space-time, we have a representation, a unitary representation of a gauge group, which usually is a compact Lie group or a finite discrete group. And the property of the theory, the physical states, the requirement for physical states is that these physical states are invariant under all such local symmetry constraints. Okay. So for any local symmetry constraint, if you apply it to the state, it remains constant. If you think about it, if you say I have a compact Lie group, and you think of UG to be the exponential of some Hermitian operator, and if you think about this exponential, for example, about as a Hermitian operator, then this equivalent is that if you apply this Hermitian operator on psi, the vector vanishes, and that, for example, can be expressed as Gauss law. I mean, so this is just a unitary version of Gauss law, if you want. Okay. So these local symmetry, additional local symmetries, actually imply that not even in an approximate sense, so even if you put the theory on a lattice, the Hilbert space is not factorized into local Hilbert spaces. So if you have a region A and its complement, then the Hilbert space, the total Hilbert space, does not factorize into HA, HA complement. Okay, so there's no way, even if you put the theory in a lattice, you cannot obtain such a composition. And that, of course, also means that the concept of a local reduced density operator is, well, let's say, ill-defined, isn't it? Because normally, if we want to talk about entanglement, we take the local density operator obtained by tracing out the rest of the system, the complement, and then we compute entropy of that density operator. But of course, because we don't have a Hilbert space decomposition into tensor products, we don't even know what a partial trace is. What is a partial trace to compute? Isn't it? So, I mean, obviously, measuring entanglement in this gauge theories has to be, well, is some open question. But operational information theoretic primitives come to help us, because the operational task of which can be used to count entanglement is still well defined. So, for example, we can ask how much entanglement we can distill. So the question is like how many EPR pairs we can distill from the theory is still well defined. Only that we have to require that we are only using physically allowed observers. Okay, so in operations, namely, which also commute with the gauge constraints, because this would leave the physical Hilbert space invariant. So the question really we are asking is like, given many copies of a state psi in a gauge theory, how many EPR pairs can we extract by acting with local gauge invariant in operations in a region or in its complement, and allowing classical communication. So this operational, this information theoretic primitive is still well defined, even without talking about any tensor product decomposition. Okay? So how can we answer this this question? How can we give an entropic quantity which measures how well we can achieve this task? So the key lemma we need for that is the following. So let's say the observable algebra of in one region, namely A, is like script A, and its commutant is everything which commutes with it, and so it's located in the complement, isn't it? So in the complement region. You can prove that the additional local symmetry constraints imply that these observable algebra and its commutant have a joint center. Okay, so and this joint center is spanned by a set of orthogonal projections, which are actually located near the boundary, at the boundary, or very close to the boundary. Okay. Joint center actually means that any element with A and element in A prime both commute with all these projections. Moreover, you can show that if you apply one of these projections to the physical Hilbert space, then the projected Hilbert space has indeed allows for a tensor product decomposition, where you can basically write down a Hilbert space for A, for the region A, and its complement. Only the full Hilbert space does not allow that. But once you project onto one of the PRs, the Rs here actually label irreducible representations of the gauge group. So once you project the physical Hilbert space on one of these PRs, you get a tensor product. Now, let us examine the consequences of that lemma. Take any operator, any physical operator in A tensor A prime. So this is any physical operator which is either located in A or in A prime, or which can, for example, be achieved, and a physical operator which can be achieved as a protocol applying local operations and allowing for classical communications. So if you have such an operator and you compute its expectation value in the state psi, you can insert twice the resolution of that entity. And then because X and PS commute, you get projections are orthogonal, you get a delta RS. And you see that actually the expectation value of X in the state psi is just the same as the expectation value of X in a depolarized state, mixed state sigma psi, which is basically defined as a mixture of all the projected parts of psi. And because for all such operators, these expectation values just agree, it means that these two states, the original state psi and its mixed state equivalent sigma psi, are physically indistinguishable for operations, for gauge invariant operations, which are either located in A or in A prime or can be achieved by LOCC. Okay, so if we are in the scenario where we have a region and its complement, and we only consider gauge invariant operations in either region, then from a physical point of view, the state psi is just as good as the state sigma psi. So we cannot distinguish the two. Yeah. So this is actually very elusive, and it already hints us to the idea that actually the entanglement, which we should understand, or which should be there, is actually the entanglement in the state sigma psi, not in the state psi, because from a physical point of view, they're equivalent. And that is what we proved last year, which also was, by the way, a QRP plenary talk this year. We proved that the distillable entanglement of the state psi, meaning the average number of EPR pairs you can obtain from many copies of the state psi by applying gauge invariant operations and allowing classical communication, is actually the distillable entanglement of the mixed state sigma psi, which is basically a mixture of the entanglement entropies of the projected parts of the state. And remember that because if you project the Hilbert space, a fixed Hilbert space, then after this projection, we can actually have a local decomposition into tensor product, and therefore can compute the partial trace and can compute its entropy. And the mixture probability is just the expectation value to basically observe the operator PR and psi. Okay. So this is the first example where using information theoretic primitives allows us to learn something about the entanglement in quantum field theories, here special gauge theory. Okay, so meaning that the usual mathematical rules kind of didn't apply, so we didn't know how to compute a density matrix. But using information theoretic primitive is a right way. You know? It gives you the right answer and it tells you, okay, what is it, how to measure entanglement in gauge. So this is the first example where using information theory primitives is useful. And well, it's a first stepping stone in that direction. So let me give you another example where using information theory primitives is helpful. This is exactly the scenario of a general quantum field theory. We are interested in an entanglement between two wedges of a general Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. So an example of a wedge, two wedges depicted here. An example of a wedge, for example, is if you have an accelerated observer, so the Unruh scenario, then the one of the wedges is basically the part of the universum this accelerated observer can observe, and the other wedge is basically the other part of the universe which is basically behind the horizon, which generated by acceleration. Okay. So, but this is only one example. That can be an illustrated one. So we are really interested in like what is the for Lorentz invariant theory, what is kind of the type of entanglement which this vacuum has. Okay. And this is really between these two spatially separated wedges. And we want to operationally characterize it. So we want to give a meaning, what it doesn't mean to be maximally entangled, or what is the entanglement in an operational way. Again, we want to use an information theoretic primitive, and the primitive we are going to use is called embezzling. It was introduced by Hayden von Van Damme, and it basically captures our idea that we can steal entanglement from states without letting them know it. So this sounds kind of crazy, because it seems that we create entanglement out of nothing, but of course there's a catch here. Namely, the exact definition is as following. So we have a sequence of bipartite states defined on a finite dimension Hilbert space, so still everything normal here. And such a sequence is called embezzling if we can find an N, if you can for any finite dimensional state, phi, and any epsilon can find an N, so make basically the local systems large enough, such that they're unitaries, local unitaries, U and V, which transform the state into the state tensor phi, okay, up to epsilon. So this is just the usual norm, Hilbert's norm. So it seems that we're kind of stealing entanglement because before that we have just the entangled state mu n, like tensor some non-entangled state. And after applying these local operations, we get the state back, tensor an arbitrary entangled state. Of course, the catch here is that everything lies in the fact that this is approximate. Okay? So embezzling property or this embezzling primitive has been studied by many authors since then. And one example is actually, which is already introduced by Hayden and Fadam, is the state which has like if 1 over square root decay of its Schmidt coefficient. Okay? And you can show that this satisfies the embezzling property. So now what? Why do I introduce that? Exactly because embezzling helps you to characterize the entanglement in the vacuum. So the result is that the vacuum between any two wedges in a Lorentz invariant theory is actually embezzling, meaning that you can, out of the vacuum, you can steal arbitrary entanglement away. Okay. So of course, so meaning that if you have the two wedges that take this unitary operators located in either the wedge or its complement, such that if you apply them to the vacuum, you get the vacuum back tensors to any state phi. Of course, the tensor product has to be replaced by a product because there's no tensor product decomposition of the Hilbert space, only a big conjoint Hilbert space for the field theory. Okay, but this is exactly which characterizes entanglement in the vacuum. It's basically, yeah, in that sense, arbitrarily entangled because we can steal any finite dimension entanglement from it. So. A few remarks. First of all, this results holds for general Lorentz invariant quantum field theories. Of course, it crucially uses the fact that we don't, in this result, we don't apply any energy bound. Right? So as soon as we apply, we have certain energy constraints, Of course, we cannot create an arbitrary entangled state phi anymore. So for example, if you have your theory, which has a mass gap, then the correlations decay exponentially. So in that sense, you have this U and V have to be closer and closer, be located at the boundary of the regions. But our result in some sense is also precise in the sense that we can actually put energy and we can put energy bounds into play and then give a relationship between what kind of D and what kind of epsilon is possible given certain assumption of the theory and the vacuum. Okay, so for example, what happens if you have a mass gap? What happens if you have for a free photon field or something like that? Okay. But what I want to stress here again is that using information theoretic primitives here, the primitive of embezzling, gives you some insights on what kind of entanglement we have to, what is the type of entanglement we deal with in quantum field theory, namely its embezzling states. By exploring that further might actually enable us to get more insight. I want to say that this is of course a result which very much is depending on the UV of the theory because it's closely related to the boundary. But nevertheless, it gives you an insight into what is the type of entanglement in this UV in the UV of the theory. And again, this is one way information theoretic primitives help you to understand the entanglement in quantum field theory. So after presenting these two results, measuring entanglement gauge theories and understanding or like characterizing entanglement general Lorentz invariant theories, I now want to go on and actually explore the bottom-up approach, bottom-up approach I was talking about, namely looking at specific theories and using the tools of tensor network theory. Yes. So again, the idea is that we want to develop UNDERT states, new classes of UNDERT states, and obtain analytic results on how well these UNDERT states approximate the field theory in question. And these UNDERT states should have a very nice defined entanglement structure so that if you can approximate the field theory by these UNDERT states, we can learn something of the entanglement structure of the quantum field theory. I will present one result in that regard, namely obtaining tensor network approximation to conformal field theories. But first, let me recall briefly what tensor network states are. So tensor network states are a family of UNDERT states which model the entanglement structure of many body systems in a local way. Isn't? So for example, in the left picture, you see that we apply a local quantum circuit onto a product state, which generates a very specific entanglement structure. And like the tensor network, for example, the easiest kind of matrix product state, exactly captures this idea that we have a very specific entanglement structure. On the right side, you see the 2D version of matrix product states, PEPs. And you again see that the combining these tensors in a local way has really the potential to obtain a geometrically local construct, a geometrically local way to study or to describe the entanglement of the theory. Okay, so and also we can explore what happens if we change that these tensor locally. So this is really important that we have a geometric local way. Okay. I of course want to mention that these tensor network states and its many variants like matrix product states, MERA, PEPs have been used in many regards, and they have been extremely successful. For example, to classify topological phases of matter, or to better obtain ground state energy than an existing field. And of course, Giffrey is one of the main contributors to that field. I want to argue now in the following that the application to quantum field theory of this theory opens up a whole new world to obtain UNDERT states, new UNDERT states, which are characterized by local objects. And therefore enable get us a new view on quantum field theory. So far, quantum field theory, most tools we're using have a very global approach, where this tensor network approach really has a potential to get us a local approach, but also focusing on the states more than on the operators. Okay, so more like we can more use the Schrödinger picture than the Heisenberg picture in some sense. So, and these are, I think, two features which are unique to this tensor network theory. Now, but first of all, if we want to apply that to quantum field theory, we have to say something. What do we mean by approximate? So as I what I presented and actually what I will focus on are discrete tensor networks. I mean, they're discrete in space and in the virtual domain. So how can we actually say that, how can we use these to say something about quantum field theories, which is defined on a continuum? Okay. How can we use these discrete structures to say something about quantum field theory? And our idea, or the idea I want to put forward, is that because quantum field theories are defined as a collection of correlation functions, and this uniquely defines the theory, if you find a tensor network, if you can obtain a tensor network which approximately has the same correlation function, then from a physical point of view, these two theories will be kind of very closely or very indistinguishable or almost the same. And so we can use the entanglement structure of the tensor network to learn something of the entanglement structure of the quantum field. Okay, so really the idea that because if we can basically reproduce any of the correlation functions, we kind of like approximate the theory, because these are actually the physical observables we want to understand. Okay? Of course, this doesn't mean at all that the states are close in any meaningful sense, because one state is living in a finite dimensional, or if we take the thermodynamic limit, it's still an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but it has a discrete spatial structure, whereas the other one is like really continuum. So the states are not close, but the physical quantities we obtain for them, they are close. So we can, in that sense, the theories are similar. Okay. So to test this idea, we first looked at this kind of simplest example of both classes. I mean, the simplest example of tensor network states are matrix product states. And the simplest and yet interesting class of the quantum field theories are conformity field theories in 1+1 dimension. Why? Because they have a much richer symmetry structure than usual Lorentz invariant quantum field. So let me first remind you just briefly what matrix product states are. These are states on a one-dimensional lattice. And we start by putting off virtual pairs of entangled particles between any two physical sites. And then we apply at each physical set inside a projector, taking one of the either both ends, so like both ends of this max, one of the one and one of the other entangled pair, and project it to a physical, to the physical Hilbert, being in that sense a local tensor. They're very nice because, for example, correlation functions can be efficiently computed. And especially various, in what was interesting for us, that various numerical and heuristic arguments support the conjecture that actually matrix product states can be used to model the entanglement structure of conformity. Of course, because if you remember the scaling of the local entanglement entropy, from it, which logarithmically, whereas matrix product states for one have a constant area law, we expect that, of course, this approximation, we learn something if we increase the further and further increase the local bond dimension. Okay. Got this. And this is the result we got, which was published in PL last year. So actually, we show that correlation functions of a conformal field theory can arbitrarily well approximate correlation by correlation functions from a matrix product algorithm. And we give an explicit bound on this error. And the bound actually leads to the following scaling. I don't want to really discuss it, but it basically captures the expectations. It matches the expectations. And we actually, the dependence, one thing I want to point out is that the dependence on the conformal field theory in question is basically described by one quantity, one constant, which in some cases we can actually relate to the central charge, not in all, but the proof holds actually for general conformal field theories in 1+1 dimension, so also interacting ones, and it uses the theory of vertex operator algebras, which is kind of an infinite dimensional equivalent of Lie algebras, and actually also can be used to make conformal field theories rigorous. So this is kind of nice, a nice tool. The proof is rigorous and constructive and allows to quantify an entanglement, I was pointing out, but also allows us to take additional symmetries into account. So for example, we can, if we study Westermeier-Witten models, which actually have more symmetries, we really can see how these symmetries act on our entanglement. Of course, I want to mention that we want to generalize this further, and one direction would be to understand MERA. So, of course, you would expect from the entanglement entropy scaling that MERA are much better suited to approximate conformal field theories. But I want to say that we for this first proof, let's say, to test our ideas, matrix product state were just easier to handle. So this is why we focused on matrix product state, and we're able to obtain this result. Okay. So now, again, I want to summarize and say that this is the first result of of the bottom-up approach, where we want to use, where we show that using tensor networks can be used to quantify and study the entanglement of quantum field theories. But of course, this is only the first result, and I would like to present you a few ideas how to extend these kind of results. In the future direction. Okay.
Okay.
So
can I ask you a question about the result? So sure. Can you move back one more slide? Yes. So in this expression you have expectation value on the CFD compared to an expectation value on a matrix product state. So what's the fit? If the matrix product state is an entity for a lattice model, are you making any assumption on the physical, on the dimension of the physical sides of this lattice? I mentioned this because on the CFT you have an infinite algebra of local operators.
Yes. So, of course. So what we, for example, one answer to that could be that if you're interested only in the expectation value of primary fields, then would be just a finite dimension set, and then we would have this dimension of the primary fields would exactly be the local physical dimension of the matrix product state.
Why do you say there is a finite set of primary fields?
A finite dimensional. So if we're considering, for example, Westermeier-Witten models or minimal models, then we have a finite set of.
With respect to the
finite dimensional. Exactly. Okay. But also we can actually allow for further descendants. Okay. So we can extend that set, and then but we have to increase the local dimension of the physical dimension of the matrix product state, of course. Then the bond dimension also scales. So the scaling I depicted here is actually for the case of primary. So if we are interested in correlation factors. Okay. So now let me talk a little bit on future directions on tensor networks, so the bottom-up approach. Again, the research goals are get a detailed understanding of the entanglement structure of general quantum field, other interesting examples than conformal field theories in one plus one dimension. As I will describe, it's actually related, and we were especially interested in its connection to the renormalization flow. And one of the main motivations, of course, of my research is that we want to develop new ansatz classes, which can serve as a starting barrier for the numerical simulation. So even though I'm interested in analytic results, having analytic results might be a very good starting point for numerical simulations, and seeing, aha, that's a good tensor network. Can we change it? Can we use it as a starting point in the optimization procedure? But also, we want to use our tensor network approximations to learn something new, to get new insights into AGSC of QFT correspondence. And one example I want to mention here is that the result of Harlow et al., which actually suggests or conjectures or puts forward the idea that the low energy subspace of certain 1 plus 1 dimensional CFTs actually constitute quantum error correcting code. Okay, so if we now would have a good tensor network description of such a low energy subspace, then we could just use the standard network to check whether the standard network has a certain quantum error correcting code, constitutes a quantum error correcting code. And we would be able to learn more about this conjecture and maybe in that sense also the ADS CFT code. But let me tell you a bit, little bit of the approach I want to use. And this actually fits very well to Gifri's last question. So because of a tensor network is, of course, a five-dimensional object, and especially the physical dimension is five-dimensional, we have to kind of render the set of physical observables on a quantum field dimension, a field theory five-dimensional. And the main idea I want to put forward is the following. So say we are only interested in observation at a certain physical scale lambda, okay? Meaning that, for example, we have a bound of a resolution or a certain energy bounds, but resolution is a good idea. Okay? Then, of course, we cannot measure exactly at one point, but our observables will be smoothed, isn't it? So they will be smoothed by certain test functions. And if we have a certain scale of resolution, then these test functions are not arbitrary, but have to be basically, they cannot vary too much. And then the idea is that if we have this set of observables, which are smooth, then at a certain scale, we can find a five-dimensional subspace of observables, which approximately recovers all the correlation functions from which are obtained from these smoothed observables at a given scale. Okay, so we have smoothed observables. And because these smooth observables are a certain class, we can approximate them very well in a certain sense by observables which are also smooth and they don't vary too much, but moreover, their span are five-dimensional in a certain region of space. Okay. So this is the first idea I want to put forward, basically how to render the set of physical observables five-dimensional. And then we will approximate, then the next, of course, the next step is to approximate to construct a tensor network approximation to the correlation functions depending on this five-dimensional subspace F lambda. Okay, so then for these observables, we will obtain a tensor network approximation. And because we have we can put exact, the goal will be to put exact error bounds on both steps, we will then have an exact error bound overall. So let me mention, without going into much detail actually, that we already are in the process of applying these ideas to free theories, and they actually work very well. Okay, so even though that this is not so interesting, it basically shows that these theories are applicable, and they work. How can we move on? How can we move on? And this is the topic of the next slide. The first idea is that an obvious idea, isn't it? So we constructed now tensor networks describing the observation at a certain scale lambda. So now it's of course interesting how this tensor network changes if we change the scale lambda. Okay. They should be constitute renormalization schemes for the tensor network. And of course, this is there's a very interesting connection to Mera, and this will have to be explored. So this, one of my main aims here. But if we have that, then I will want to put forward a further idea, actually, how to obtain, especially if we start from free theories, how to get to interacting theories. There's only one approach, but it's very. I want to provide it to you, tell it to you, because it's very closely related to already existing tools in quantum field. Namely, we will use the theory of exact renormalization flow equations developed by Polchinski, Keller, Kopper et al. To add perturbations, or to add interactions perturbing. Now, what is the idea of the renormalization flow equations? The idea is that if you have a theory, then which depends on a certain scale, the correlation functions depend on a scale, and then you take the derivative of this correlation function with respect to the scale, then you actually can show that this derivative of the correlation function at a scale can be expressed at a linear expression of correlation functions of the same scale, but in one order lower in perturbation theory. Excuse me. So you get a recursive set of equations how to build up the correlation functions. So we will, our idea, so my idea is to develop this idea further and apply it to tensor networks. So in that way, we will be able to recursively update the tensor to do perturbation theory. So for example, we could start off from a fixed point or like a free theory and add perturbations in that regard. Okay? This is one of my ideas. Of course, different renormalization schemes will lead to different tensor network approximations there. For example, interesting question, how MIRA compares to PEPS. So this is one of the questions I want to study. Okay. Again, I want to mention that this is only one of the ideas I have to look at interacting theories. But I think it's a very appealing one because it's very closely related to also to tools which are already available in quantum field theory. And actually, this exact renormalization flow equations, actually, you can obtain exact error bounds. So this is another nice thing you can exploit. Okay, so after this, like my the set of ideas I wanted to present you on how to further obtain the network approximation to quantum field theories. And let me now talk about a little bit about the future ideas of mine related to the top-down approach. So again, the idea is to apply information theoretic primitives to quantum field theory. And especially I'm interested in certain what's called meta protocols, like quantum state merging or quantum hypothesis testing, and generalize these concepts to quantum information. So to remind you, for example, quantum state merging is a setup where we have a tripartite state, Alice, Bob, Charlie, and Bob wants to send his part of the state to Alice while preserving all the correlations with Charlie. Okay? So this seems to be a kind of a weird scenario, but actually you can show that quantum state matching is a very powerful primitive. It lies at the heart of many quantum communication protocols and can be related to sending information over noisy channels and several other things. So like applying this, generalizing these concepts to quantum field theory will then allow us to like obtain many other generalizations also as a consequence. One of the motivations for this actually is independent from quantum field theory is that by doing so, we will obtain new bipartite and also multipartite coding schemes for information transition over gauge channels, photonic channels, with a continuum of degrees of freedom, or the continuum of modes. So in usual quantum information so far, we are only considering a finite set of modes. Okay? But this is actually not the physical scenario. So if you think about a photonic fiber, the channel it creates, of course, uses all the modes of the light. This is like a continuum of modes of light. The discretization is only one of our physical approximations to the scenario. And actually, we don't know how good this approximation is. So by generalizing, for example, quantum state matching, just even to free theories, even just free photons, we would be able to develop new coding schemes for this case of Gaussian quantum channel, which is like one of the main future topics in continuous variable quantum information theory. But also, I think we want to use this information theoretic primitives to get a further ideas of, for example, of the black hole fireball paradox. Okay? So black hole fireball paradox is based on very plausible, but yet heuristic applications of concept from quantum information theory to quantum field theory. But generalizing and so generalizing these quantum information theoretic primitives to quantum field theory in a certain analytic rigorous way would, I think, also enable us to further get insights on like what does it mean, further understanding of this paradox, let's say. For example, I might connect to our earlier results on distillable entanglement, isn't it? There we saw actually that the distillable entanglement is quite different than, let's say, what they used to just computable entanglement, well, where it was even unclear how to define a reduced density matrix. So in that case, it might be actually that notions like distillable entanglement or something might be of use here actually to get further understandings into this paradigm. Okay, but let me now talk about the approach we want to take to generalize these primitives to quantum primitives. So quantum communication protocols, for example, quantum state merging. The proof of that, or the study of that, is split in two parts, the direct and the converse part. In the direct part, we are constructing a certain coding scheme. So we are constructing a certain way to achieve a task. Okay, it might be through random coding or several techniques. And then there's a converse task part, which actually shows that this way of obtaining of doing the protocol is actually optimal. Okay, and both parts together actually lead to that understanding of information theoretic primitive. Okay, so there's a way, there's something, it's a bound on how good you can achieve something, and then there's a proof that you can achieve something that good. Okay, so this, and of course, you need both parts to really understand the primitive. Okay. So, how we will look at these two parts? So, first of all, the direct part, actually generating the direct part. We will use our tensor network approximations. Why? Because a tensor network is a five-dimensional object. So there we actually can apply the usual tools from quantum information theory and develop protocols to, for example, do state merging. And then because we know that the tensor network is an approximation to the quantum field theory, we can use this approximation statement, because we have analytic error bounds, to lift the protocol to the actual quantum field theory. Okay, so really this approximation will allow us to first develop the direct part on the tensor network part and then lift it to the quantum field. The converse part is in any of such primitives actually usually related or studied by using certain entropic quantities like conditional entropies, Rényi-like entropies. And so also in this case, we have to extend these entropic quantities and its properties to quantum field theories. Or actually, in some sense, we can just be even more general and extend them to general operator algebras, which then describes observable algebras of quantum field theories. And there's also actually ongoing work and already have some results in that regard. So this will be extended and then applied to this. To this specific question. Okay, so I hope I could convince you that these two ideas, like how to obtain the direct part and the converse part, actually both very plausible and will allow us to generalize primitives, information theoretic primitives, like quantum state merging to quantum field theory. And if we can do so, then we can actually look for potential applications, either develop coding schemes or actually look into a paradox like the black hole paradox and get some further insight into that. And with that, I would like to conclude. I hope I could convince you that applying concept from quantum information theory, co-quantum field theory, is worthwhile. It leads to new insights into the structure of entanglement. And it's also necessary because if you want to get further insights into the quantum nature of these fundamental forces of nature, we have to understand the entanglement. And because entanglement is, of course, described and first studied really in quantum information theory, the tools of quantum information theory are the right ones to look at these questions. I hope I could show you that there's actually ample ideas on how to do that, and actually then there are many potential applications of this generalization. Again, the research strategy I presented is twofold. First, we have a top-down approach, which is focusing on applying information theoretic primitives onto general quantum field theories, which are, for example, just defined in terms of certain axioms, and then using these primitives to learn something about the general entanglement features. But also we have a bottom-up approach, which is based on tensor network theory and which uses the tools of tensor network theory to obtain geometrically local models of the entanglement present in quantum. And I presented both results as well as future ideas connect to both of these two-fold strategy. And I will convince you that this is an exciting field to work on. And with that, I would like to thank you.
Do we have any questions?
Kick things off then. Volker, when you were talking about tensor network approximations to 1 plus 1 CFTs,
yeah.
Would anything interesting have to be changed in your approach if I wanted to introduce conformal boundaries? Like rather than a line, I have a half line and a...
Yeah, we looked at this question, but actually, our analysis doesn't quite apply to that case. I mean, of course, it's an interesting question, this has to be further analyzed, actually. Our proof goes a little bit like that. We first consider like chiral theories, meaning that we only look at the chiral or the anti-chiral part. Mm. But then we also look at the full theory where we actually combine the chiral and the anti-chiral part. But of course, in boundary conformal field theories, the chiral and the anti-chiral part are not like independent.
Right.
So we would need to work a little bit more on that regard and like see how the tools actually generalize. I'm actually thinking more into the. I'm a little bit more optimistic in if we obtain a result concerning Mera that theirs might be simpler. So we are looking back a little bit into that regard, actually. But yeah, so I hope that answers your question.
Okay. Can I ask about embezzlement and the wedges? You were being very carefully saying spatially separated wedges, and I things went by too quickly. I couldn't. What was the role of the spatially separated, or what is that?
So with spatially separated, I kind of mean that it's like one time slice, isn't it? So we have one time slice and then a wedge, and it's reach. So spatially separated. Sorry, they can be touching. It's not that what I meant. I mean more like
it wasn't.
Yeah, they can be. Spatially separated. I actually meant that more like that. They are one time slice. So
okay.
Like really. So I wasn't exactly precise about that. Yes. So, actually, they should be better touching. For example, if you have an exponential decay of correlation, if you have a mass gap, for example. Then of course these fetches have to be very close in order that you can exploit this correlation.
Okay.
Because it's really a UV. In that case, it would be really a UV property, isn't it? Because you extract the entanglement really from the UV. Because in the IR, there's actually no entanglement. If you power law decay, also then of course the most of the entanglement is located very close to the boundary of that, isn't it? So.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me ask you, most of the discussion you had on tensor networks for approximate, or you talked about rigorous bounds for characterizing the approximation of correlations on a conformal or on a quantum field theory by correlators that you can accomplish with a tensor network. So there were not many details there, but of course you didn't have a chance to explain it in detail. But I was wondering how this generalizes to the case of current interest of continuous tensor networks. If we have a continuous matrix product state, is your discussion translatable in a simple way to that framework?
So actually, our proof for the for the conformality can be, especially if you look at certain examples like Westermin and Witten models, can be generalized to continuous MPS and give similar mounts. Of course, like in the stuff I, especially the future prospects, I mean, the connection to CIMERA would be, of course, extremely interesting in that regard. I mean, in the talk, I focused mostly on discrete tensor networks because, for example, there we know how to compute correlation expectation values efficiently. So in CIMERA, I mean, for CPS it's also clear, but CIMERA, this is like kind of like less clear at the moment how to compute that, isn't it? So that's why I focus on my talk of that. But of course, like this general idea is the first idea I put forward to actually look at like only at observers at a certain scale. Of course, that of course very well can be also be applied to a CIMERA and to start off with a CIMERA. Of course, then you don't need to make this first step, but nevertheless the second step obviously. And also like the stuff I talked about, this exact generalization flow equations will also be applicable to a CIMERA or like a CFP or whatever. I tend to actually study these two questions on a similar line or basically in parallel, but I think because the tools are actually very similar, so if you get an insight into one, you probably get an insight into the other case. But in the talk, I focused actually on the discrete part because actually for, I think one important and for me actually pleasant feature of these discrete things is that we can compute expectation values efficiently.
Any other questions? Let's thank Walter again.